Welcome to the Free Dev Cafe, episode 106 with Emilio Rodriguez Alvarez. My name is Donnie. I'm the host of the Free Dev Cafe. The Free Dev Cafe is the long-form interview podcast that explores the backstories, the training, the challenges, the combined wisdom and personal philosophies of the world's free divers. The website is at freedevcafe.com and the show is available on all good podcast players. Just search for Free Dev Cafe. Free Dev is one word, by the way. Over on Patreon, we just released the latest exclusive interview in the Free Diver Stories series. I interviewed Hawaii-based Billy Middleton about his free diving journey. Check that out at patreon.com/freedivecafe. Big love to new patron and friend Madison over there in Israel. How's it going, Maddie? Now on today's episode over here in the regular Free Dive Cafe, we have a very interesting discussion, something a little different to the usual offering on the podcast. Let's face it, we can only listen to so many fancy pants, top level freediving athletes before we get bored senseless. So today I called in the man who I'm calling the Indiana Jones of freediving from the land of Galicia, Emilio Rodriguez Alvarez. Emilio is an archaeologist specializing in the archaeology of ancient Greece, the study of pottery technology, geographic information systems, and maritime archaeology. He finished his BA at the University of Santiago de Compostela and took his MA from the University of Reading. After working in Galicia, he moved to the University of Arizona in order to work on his PhD. Emilio is a keen freediver himself and is especially interested in the ancient divers of the Mediterranean. He's done work for example, on sponge harvesting in the archaeological record of the Mediterranean basin, and also has a general fascination with all the indigenous traditional freediving cultures still extant around the world and what we can learn from them. Today we have a fun discussion on the origins of freediving in Homo sapiens and even before Homo sapiens, and spend some time speculating on freediving in antiquity. And Emilio has some real nice little gems to share with us, including stuff about the Ama, the Bajau, the Moken, ancient nose clips, mouthfuls of olive oil, the Epic of Gilgamesh. You'll see what I mean. Before we get to Emilio, we must, of course, sing the praises of our sponsors today. That is, of course, To Be Free Equipment. You all know by this point that I'm in love with the buoys from this company. I literally today just finished setting up a brand new one with an 80-meter line and can't wait to get it in the water for its maiden voyage. To Be Free also makes a whole range of professional quality freediving accessories and equipment, including fins, lanyards, pulley systems, rope stoppers, competition quality non-stretch dive lines, and bottom plates. They even have an inflatable counterballast system, which I'm unable to get my hands on, but I'm extremely intrigued by that. Big boss man of To Be Free, world champion freediver Alexander Bubenchikov, is very generously giving all Free Dive Cafe listeners a 10% discount on anything you order from To Be Free. All you have to do is go to the website and put Free Dive Cafe into the discount code box at checkout, and you're all set. The website is 2, that's the number 2, B, the letter B, and freeequipment.com. All right, time to take a trip down the ancient history lane with freediving's Indiana Jones, Emilio Rodriguez Alvarez. Let's dive. All right, cool. Well, let's just see what happens. This is for me, like archaeology and ancient history and stuff like that is like a completely fascinating topic for me. And I mean, let's just get into it and see what we can piece together as a conversation on this topic. I'm not even entirely sure that I understand what the topic is in a super concrete way, but let's say ancient free diving, history of free diving, ancient history of free diving, something like that. Before we get onto that, I want to just give you a chance to introduce yourself and explain to the listeners who you are. And I've totally forgotten that we need to turn our cameras off, so let's turn our cameras off. So all right, Emilio, tell us a little bit about who you are, where you're from, and we'll go from there.
Great. Well, hi. I am Emilio Rodriguez Alvarez. I am from Vigo, from Galicia, in the northwest corner of the Iberian Peninsula of Spain. And basically, I am a postdoctoral researcher and archaeologist. I work mainly on ancient Greece and ancient technology. And one day I had this crazy idea and this crazy questions about asking myself about sponge divers and free divers in the archaeological record. I like free diving. I practice in an amateur just for fun way. I'm by no means the kind of person that you usually interview here. No world record, not trying to reach my 100. But I love free diving and I love the sea. And I thought it would be a very fun topic to do some work on.
Yeah, so the papers that you have sent me and some of the links to the research that you have been involved in center on ancient Greece and sponge diving and things like that. Now, I think, you know, as you suggested before, that, we're talking about a topic where there's not a huge body of evidence at the moment, and that was something that you you know brought up pre-interview, and so maybe you could talk a little to that, and then also start to explain for the listeners how your discipline of ancient archaeology works and how you go about doing the science.
Sure. Well, actually, one of my presentations in an international conference, I call it like the hidden divers, because they are actually hidden. Everything started one afternoon in the library of the American School at Athens. I was there as a regular member, and it was just too much reading on the Oracle of Dodoni of Zeus, you know, and this traditional archaeology stuff, and I was missing the sea. And my mind started to wonder, thinking about the ocean and thinking about, you know, going free diving sometime. And I asked myself, what do I know about free diving in antiquity? Because, I mean, they had to free dive. And everything started with the sponges, because I know that in ancient times, sponges were a kind of multi-purpose material. You know, they use it in the bathroom, of course, but also in medicine. They even used them to put, like, inside helmets when they were going to war. Right. Kind of to prevent the helmet from constantly like hitting the head, you know, the metal part.
Some cushioning, some absorption of shock absorption.
Absolutely. So, I mean, it's ubiquitous. It's everywhere. But I know nothing about free divers. I started in ancient Greece. Now I'm working all around the world. So I started to gather evidence. And what I learned is that there was no evidence. I could find only one paper, literally, from Frost, 1968, Skilias, Diving in Antiquity, which was a catalog of texts, of, you know, ancient texts describing free diving, which was great, don't get me wrong, because it was a great index to start with, but no archaeology. You know, archaeology is we study past communities and past societies through the material record, through the things, the tools, you know, that they left behind, and the objects, and I had nothing about that. So I started to develop my own, you know, methodology and my own theories on how can I address this topic. in the archaeological record, and that was the beginning, if you want to put it that way, of all this research.
That's interesting what you said there about this one paper that you found, referencing a catalog of ancient freedivers. Let's use that as our starting point for what we had in the
sure.
scientific record, and explain a little bit about what was in there.
So what we have in there was, as I said, a collection of references, the work of free divers according to these texts. They were basically gathering food and other items from the sea, seashells, fishes, and sponges, as I said. But there was also like an extensive body of evidence on warfare, using divers as some kind of commandos, if you want. The best comparison I've been able to find is with the underwater demolition teams of the U.S. Navy in World War II in the Pacific Theater of Operations. These guys were basically free diving with a mask and some fins, and they were preparing the beach areas of the islands of the Pacific before the Marines landed, removing obstacles and things like that. Countermeasures that the Japanese were putting on the shores. And actually, one of the references, for example, is Athenians using divers exactly to do the same task, sawing some timber the Syracusans put on their harbor to avoid their landing. And that blew up my mind, that comparison could be made. The problem with these texts, which is a problem I have in general on my research, is that both the ancient writer, but most commonly the translator in the present day, knew nothing or almost nothing about free diving. So many things that these texts are describing that I can relate to common freediving activities or freediving issues, they didn't get them. So the evidence, let's say, gets diluted. One example, for example, they criticize, the best body is Oppian's Haleutica, is from the 2nd century CE. I can give you any link and things like that if you want to put on the show notes.
Yeah, definitely. Let's put them in the show notes, yep.
Sure. But basically, this is a person who is giving the best, most complete description of the work of divers in antiquity, okay? And he talks about, for example, capturing fishes by hand. And the translators always make these kind of comments or footnotes saying, okay, obviously, this makes no sense. Who is going to be able to capture fishes by hand? This is just the kind of thing, I remember one translator saying, this is the kind of thing the divers would tell Oppian, the ancient author, about their job to show off. Mm-hmm. Like, kind of lie, showing off, obviously they couldn't do this, and then it's like, hold on. I've seen videos of this, I've seen videos of divers, for example, capturing octopi underwater with the bare hands, So that kind of cleaning, if you want to put it that way, of making sense as somebody who likes free diving of this information was the first step in this research,
Yeah, that reminds me of, stories of the... ancient Polynesian divers and the accounts that came back of them diving for, 7 or 8 or 15 minutes in one case, I think. And, obviously there's nobody who's going down to do a hunting dive for 15 minutes. But if you're standing there on the shore and you have never seen somebody do this before, you might lose track of time a little bit. And then you might also be prone to... exaggerating the facts, and it would seem quite magical to your eyes that somebody would be able to do that, especially back in ancient history. So there's a couple of things I want to come back to there, but I totally understand about the difficulty of doing research in this area. But let's start off by just being purely speculative and taking a little dive into the very ancient history of free diving, to excuse the pun. when I do my free diving courses, there's a section at the beginning of the course which is there's just a line on the slide which says free diving can be learned, and I always explain this to my students that you know, as humans, we're as human beings, as organisms, as animals, we're quite good at diving. We have you know, some would say that we're lucky that we can develop the skills to free dive, but I think it's probably more likely, in my eyes, that you know we are quite well suited to the water through our evolution, and probably a lot of that is to do with just, you know, tens, hundreds of thousands of years living by the water and doing the most natural thing, which is to put your hand in, eventually put your head in, and eventually put your whole body in, and take whatever kind of easy pickings you can find there, and maybe sometimes mm-hmm. not mm-hmm. even so easy pickings. But in your opinion, Emilio, how far back do you think, you know, how do you consider that we started free diving in the first place? And you know, let your imagination go wild.
Sure. As you said, I think the most plausible scenario is just that picking you were describing. You know, even up to this day, in my homeland in Galicia, people pick up razor clams, I think is the proper name in English. Yeah. You know, Atlantic.
The long kind
clam.
Of shells.
Yeah. Just by freediving. So that idea of, you know, picking up food that you cannot get, let's say, on the dry part of the shore, makes total sense to me. One of the strategies I develop is, okay, I have not much material culture, and we can talk about that later, tools, if you want, but I've got something that is kind of common, and it's basically human beings diving. We know that while free diving, we can develop some issues, some health issues. One of them, which gets into the bones, and that is important because usually the soft tissue disappears, but not the bones, is auricular exostosis or surfer's ear. Yeah, it's common among divers and free divers. So I started to look for that marker, if you want, on material record, on basically bones from past societies. And in fact, there is a cave in northern Iraq called Shanidar Cave, which to begin with obviously has no relationship with the shores, you know, with the Mediterranean. It's relatively close to the rivers, you know, the Mesopotamia, where we have Neanderthals. So not even Homo sapiens, ourselves, you know. Neanderthals, in this cave, they were there between 80,000 to 60,000 years ago. And there is an astonishing high number of skulls with auricular exostosis, which has been interpreted by many scholars as caused by diving. You know, by gathering food or perhaps fishing on the river or picking up things on the river, but spending a lot of time with your head under the water, if you want to put it simple. And yeah, it's not even imagination. I can totally see that happening. And that would be the earliest evidence, at least I've been able to find, which I think is pretty astonishing because, again, we are Homo sapiens. This is happening with our, you know, sister species. It's not even ourselves in the sense of genetically modern humans, you know?
Yeah, so it's not even like Homo sapiens are pioneers in breath hold diving. It's that, you know, we have inherited and share these skills from a much deeper lineage, potentially.
Yeah, I mean, we share time in our prehistory with Neanderthal until they disappear. But I just find fascinating that it's not limited to us. You know what I mean? Limited to us, I mean to Homo sapiens. We appear around 300,000 years ago. There are some sites in Morocco that point to 315,000 years ago. So we share a lot of time with Neanderthals. As you said, I'm not being the scientist, I'm being the crazy guy who loves freediving. But that idea of sapiens and Neanderthals sharing their love for freediving, is very appealing to me. What can I say?
Yeah, maybe it was them that taught us how to do it. You never know.
It's the problem with archaeology. It's like a puzzle where you have no box picture, and of the 2,000 pieces, you have 37. So it's always very difficult to get the exact shot, you know.
Yeah, yeah,
but
yeah.
What we know is that is extremely old. It is extremely, extremely old.
Yeah. Okay, then let's jump forward a little bit in time and into not such a speculative realm. Now, I'm not sure how much you know on this subject, but perhaps, you know, there's no need to be like completely 100% accurate about this topic. But maybe you can, you know, for the listeners who are super interested in finding out more about ancient indigenous cultures, free diving, maybe you could give us a quick rundown of the various cultures around the world where we still see a traditional free diving culture in terms of using free diving for hunting and gathering for food. I'm talking about the Bajau and the Ama and things like that. Maybe you could sort of give us a list of all the top ones that you know about.
Sure. And in fact, they have been extremely useful on my research. There is something we call ethnoarchaeology, like putting very simple, is getting these modern cultures, see how they perform a task in this sense, or in this case, sorry, free diving. And that can give us a lot of ideas about, you know, getting these techniques to the past and compare the material culture. One thing I love about the Bajau Lao, in my opinion, is that recently they have evolved for free diving, and that is like, I mean, amazing research. There is a scholar called Melissa Ilardo who has published a paper like a couple of years ago on the Bajau Lao and the Bajau Lao genetics. And to keep it like very, very simple, I'm sure you know, and all your audience know, the importance of the spleen on free diving. Yeah. So there is a gene, the PPE10A gene. Okay, that is related to the size of your spleen. You have it, I have it, everybody has it. Okay? The point is that this, let's say, make your spleen bigger gene is extremely, extremely, extremely common among the Bajau Lao. And you can say, well, Emilio, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, they are great free divers, they are free diving the whole time. That's the point. We are talking about a gene. You can train free diving. You cannot train a gene. You have it or you don't. Yeah, that's a basic principle of evolution. So they tested this gene on the Bajau Lao communities, and all Bajau Lao have a tendency to have this gene, even those who are not divers.
Right.
We are talking about people who have been, for example, farming their whole life. Okay? No relationship to the sea. They have left, you know, this marine culture, if you want. They also have this gene that is indicating a larger spleen on them. So I find it fascinating because what you have here is a community that has genetically evolved to be much more efficient in diving. And finding this paper and this research was just blow-minding for me. I mean, it was amazing to discover that, you know, that they are basically better prepared from a genetic point of view for free diving.
I will say, yeah, it reminds me of that I've heard that I'm not sure about that. I've heard that the indigenous peoples of the Himalaya, the Sherpas, you know, the those you know, people who have been living up, you know, thousands of meters up into the mountains, also have a genetic tendency towards the genetic changes that allow them to process oxygen more efficiently, and they do that on a genetic level, not just that they are trained that way.
Sure, I mean, in the end, we are talking about red blood cells, yeah. And oxygen, if you want to put it that way, you know, in the heights of the Himalayas or under the water. Yes, we need to remember that we are animals. I mean, and we are tied to the same rules of evolution as any species, you know. So it makes total sense. This study has been done on the Bayau Lao. One thing I suggest, so this is also a good example of how ethnoarchaeology works, that, well, the spleen is soft tissue. You know, we cannot apply the same rules I was mentioning before to bone preservation, which is more common in archaeology, when I was mentioning Shanidar Cave and the Neanderthals. But we know that there was a pre-Columbian culture, a pre-Hispanic culture in South America, the Chinchorro culture. We know this culture, they were free divers. They are also characterized by this surfer's ear, this auricular exostosis we were chatting about before. But these guys mummified, they're dead. So one of the things I would like to do in the future as an archaeological, you know, scientific research is to be able, if I can find this correlation between bigger spleen in these Chinchorro communities compared to, in this case, the modern case of the Bayau Lao, you know, because, well, this was another freediving community that we know, and because they mummified their dead, they preserved the soft tissue. So that is the kind of tools I had to develop for doing my research to get this idea of comparing and getting the information from the sources I have. Other famous cultures, you mentioned the Ama, and you have also in Korea the Hanayo, and I do apologize for the pronunciation if I am doing wrong.
I think it's Hainyo.
Yeah, thank you. And those are some of the best known. But one of the latest I have found on my research, which also goes back to even before the arrival of the Spanish conquistadors, is in the northern shores of Venezuela, diving for pearls. And we have evidence of that, at least from the Mayan times. And they were basically diving as in the Mediterranean. So in South America, some tribes in Chile also were very good at free diving. The evidence is there. It was just scattered and, as I said before, kind of hidden, you know, from the record. The Ama in Japan, I think they play a much larger cultural role in the overall culture of Japan. And they are probably the best known case, but also a very good example of the risks we as a modern world and modern society. Sorry for the anthropological off topic right now, but I think it's important to consider this.
Yeah, please, you know, yeah.
That sometimes we admire a culture so much that we destroy it or we hurt it. And the commercialization of the Ama culture has changed Ama culture forever. If you read about the Ama in the late 19th, early 20th century, and then there is a volume published in the late 1950s or early 60s, on Ama physiology, Ama culture, Ama traditions, Ama economy, and you see the Ama today, there is an impact. You know, tourism is great. It can help developing many societies and communities, but it's also a risk. And I think the Ama are an excellent example of that.
Do you know much about the Moken in Thailand? Are they similar to the Bajau?
Yeah, there is another culture, and I think it's happening the same. In fact, I was watching like a couple of months ago Spanish traveling documentary on the Moken, and they were actually mentioning some of these issues I was mentioning with the Ama. You know that. The real Moken are disappearing, and saying that on TV was a little bit risky. You know, what are the real Moken? What do you mean by that? We cannot tell the Moken what to do or what to be, but it's obvious that if you have a community that is basing its economy on some specific resources and you take those resources away, they need to change their lifestyle. So I really would like to go and also research the Moken. But I'm afraid that they are going through some of the similar processes the Bayau Lao are going as well.
Yeah, this is super interesting because I lived in Thailand for about 6 months, and most of that time I lived on an island called Koh Lanta in the Andaman Sea. And what's crazy is that I was teaching yoga there, and I had a kind of a yoga deck on the beach. It was an incredible location. It was literally like at high tide, the waves would be lapping meters away from the edge of this deck. absolutely picture postcard perfect Thai beach. And then just to the left side of this deck where the was where the Mokken would come in, and they would go out on their boats. And at the time, I've been told that they were the sea people, or that they were the sea nomads, or whatever. But they were right there next to me, and I was seeing them every day, and I had no idea, because I never at that time I wasn't so involved in the free diving world. But it's amazing how close I was to having a chance to actually have found out more about them and communicated with them. So it would be interesting to. But what I do remember is that, like you were saying, this community was not treated very well.
No,
They didn't
they aren't.
have very, very much in the way of material possessions. They didn't really have any. They were living in shacks, basically, and they didn't look like very happy people. And yeah, that was 8 years ago. So it would be interesting to go back and see how things have changed for them now.
It's always a risk in anthropology, especially, like as a scholar, I don't want an colleagues, we don't want to be kind of paternalist, like to tell what is good or bad. That's not our job, obviously, or to judge these communities or anything like that. We are there to record and learn with the utmost respect, obviously, for these communities. But I find very curious how we Westerners, or in the Western world, we are fascinated. I am fascinated, I confess that, for the Bajau Lao or the Mokem. Yet, as you said, in their local communities and their daily life, if you want to put it that way, they are not very well regarded. Some people in the past has used this name of in English at least, of sea gypsies, with negative connotations, which obviously has nothing to do with the word gypsy, but with the way they were describing and using the term in a diminishing way, which it is not, but it was the intention, So yeah, I'm a little bit scared sometimes when I watch these documentaries, for example, that I shout to the TV like, "Hey, those are human beings, you're not recording animals in the savannah. Those are human beings, show some respect on the way you address these narratives and the way you interact with these communities. They are not there to do their thing to please you so you can record it." And I think this is an important thing to consider, and it's something that if you read the latest news on the AMA and so on, for example, because I think it's the easiest to find a resource on modern diving communities and cultures, that the you have many news on the internet and online publications and so on the last of the AMA, these 70, 80 years old ladies who are still diving, on a daily basis for abalone and for seaweeds and so on, which are the ones performing that. And many, many times people say they don't want us to record them. They are tired of that, they don't want us to take pictures. They just want to do their thing. And that, I think, is the consequence of being there all the time, like recording them. They just want to work along and do their thing and come back home. And we should understand that and respect that, to be honest. I would love to work with the AMA, but if I go there and they don't want to work with me, I'm fine. It's their life. What can I say?
Hey, my amazing merfolk, just allow me a few seconds to remind you that as a Patreon supporter, you A, get to ask questions of the guests, B, get extra long versions of the episodes featuring the Desert Island Questions section, C, you get ultra high fidelity audio recordings of the podcast, D, you get exclusive episodes either only for your ears, such as the Freediving Story series, or episodes released way in advance, such as the Training Talk episodes. All you have to do is head over to patreon.com/freedivecafe and do what needs to be done. Many thanks to all current patrons. You keep the lights on and the coffee flowing, so big love to you all. All right, let's get back to Emilio. Yeah, I mean it's obviously difficult in a situation like that where you've kind of you don't want to be the tourist showing up and doing the touristy things, but it's almost impossible to not be, in a sense, because they're just people who are living life the way that they've always lived life, and they consider themselves normal, and then we kind of make a bit of a big deal out of them. What about in Polynesia? I mean, obviously Polynesia is a huge area with many different kind of flavors to the cultures there. I don't know very much about Polynesian freediving culture. I know a little bit about the some pearl divers. Maybe you could tell us more.
Sure. I mean, one of the fascinating things that I'm doing right now is precisely pearl diving, sorry, but all around the world. What I've been discovering lately is that human beings apparently love pearls. As I was saying before, one of the keys for the success of these first works I've been done is to locate things that not directly, but at least indirectly can point to divers, and pearls are one of them. I may not have the divers, but I have the things they left behind. Pearl diving, I'm working more that in Polynesia right now on the Arabian Gulf about that topic because it's extremely rich. We know we have pearl divers in Polynesia, and there are some myths that I'm trying to find like good editions of these tales to work with. There are several myths of Ama diving for pearls in Japanese culture and mythology as well. We have pearl divers, as I said, in the Mayan area in the north of Venezuela. But for me, the most fascinating thing is that people relate the earliest evidence we have on a text about free diving precisely to pearl diving. I don't know if you ever heard of the Epic of Gilgamesh.
Yes, this is a Sumerian epic, right?
Yes, absolutely right. It's a Sumerian epic. We've got the earliest copies from the library of a ruler called Ashurbanipal in the 8th century BCE. But the tale of Gilgamesh dates back to 2500 to 1000 BCE. So much older. Well, tablet 11, it's tablet because they wrote on clay tablets, not on the papyrus scrolls we are perhaps more used to think about. It's about diving. He wanted to be immortal to gain like eternal life, and he had to gather a plant that was growing underwater. And basically, you have the description of a dive that really, really resembles a Scandalopetra. By the way, this Greek technique that now is a competition, and is the earliest textual evidence of how to perform a dive. And many scholars relate these to the divers who we know 3000 BCE, 2500 BCE, were diving already for pearls in which is nowadays, Qatar or other United Arab Emirates and these areas of the Persian Gulf.
So it just there's more evidence there for real breath-hole diving going back thousands of years. When we talk about in terms of this is just a question that I think is going to come up on the minds of some of the listeners.
Sure.
How deep do you think what's the deepest like you've heard of someone diving in a traditional sense, in a hunter-gathering sense, or something like that?
Well, what I've been able to find, both in ancient and modern texts, I would dare to say around 30 meters. The reason is actually pretty obvious, I think. In fact, most of the dives probably took place between 8 and 15 meters. We have a lot of records on pearl diving, precisely on the Persian Gulf, like in the early 20th century, which means that it's very close to us, which means that we have a lot of information. If we want to compare their techniques to a modern equivalent, I would say they are closer to spear fishing than competitive free diving, and it makes sense in the sense that what they wanted was to collect, again, pearls, but also food or seaweed. So it was more about repetition than depth. in their case, you know. We have records, Oppian's or Pliny, the Roman historian Pliny, the one who died when Pompeii and Mount Vesuvius and so on, mention depths of around up to 30 meters.
Yeah, I think it makes sense. And I think also from, I mean, it's interesting how there's the aspect that, you know, the vast majority of the world's reef systems and easily accessible food is between, you know, 5 and 30 meters. And then you also have physiologically for human beings, it's just it's with training, it's relatively easy to achieve depths of 20 to 30 meters and dive regularly and repetitively at those depths. That's kind of why like a level one and a level two free diving course are, you know, reasonably attainable to do together in a reasonably short period of time. But diving below 30 meters starts to, you know, it starts to become a much more challenging and much more involved endeavor. So I think our actual human physiology connects very nicely just to the natural environment, and it makes perfect sense.
Totally agree. I mean, I think you're absolutely right. And also what you want is a time at the bottom rather than depth, because you want to stay, you know, if you stay there 3 minutes, you can pick up more stuff by dive that you stay 15 seconds, you know. So I think that is the idea. The ancient authors also mention what we understand nowadays to be narcosis or hemoptysis, you know, like bleeding or hypoxia, which are usually, I mean, they can happen obviously at freediving competitions, but they relate those things more to the repetition of dives, you know, that a diver has been diving the whole day, no stop, no relax, and they develop these problems. Aristotle, the Greek philosopher, mentions something about the divers putting like a needle through their eardrums to basically perforate them, and that way they don't need to equalize, because all authors obviously mention the issue of equalization and describe it. We need to understand that these authors are writing for people who are not related to the sea. They just don't get the sea. They don't understand the sea. So something as equalization for them is kind of fascinating. I'm not very sure about that, to be honest, because I wonder myself. First, I think it's just super painful. Every time I have to write or think about it, I just find it so painful. honestly, to do it on purpose, not as an accident, because you are diving, you know, but as I'm gonna do it on purpose. So when I jump with my lead weight, like in the Scandalopetra style, I don't need to equalize. I just cannot imagine that. But also, your eardrum is going to heal eventually. So are you doing this repeatedly? It's something I need to gather more information, to be honest. It's a single reference. Yeah. I know, for example, that pearl divers in the Persian Gulf, they use nose clips. They had nose clips. And we have these artifacts made with the turtle shells, basically. So they as we can see on freediving competition today, to help them equalize when they were diving, nose clips. Simple.
That's crazy. Yeah, that's super interesting.
Yeah.
And what you mentioned there about Aristotle and eardrum piercings, which is honestly one of the most awful things that I can possibly think of.
Yeah, it's a little bit gruesome.
But you know, I've also heard the rumors, and you've also heard the rumors too, that the Greek divers would deliberately blow out their eardrums when the older Greeks would make the younger guys, you know, blow out their ears so that they wouldn't have this equalization issue in the future. Do you think, is that just myth or is that real?
That's a great question, because when I read this line in Aristotle, that's the first thing I thought about, and I'm sure that many free divers, many listeners are familiar to this reference, because it's rather common in many free diving books. You know, they mention this. I need more research. What can I say? Now is the scientist coming back to my brain.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's a lie. I think we need to be careful with the timeline. What do I mean by this? The free divers, the spongoteroi, which is the ancient Greek name to these sponge divers, diving in 2500 years ago, they are diving in a Mediterranean that is not so spoiled. I mean, that we are destroying the planet, I can assure you, is nothing new. If you do your archaeology, you know that it's nothing new. The scale changes, you know. Now we are destroying the entire planet and the entire oceans. But that humans go to an area and deplete it locally or regionally, it's nothing new. So we have that reference from the, you know, these Greek sponge divers from the 19th century, for example, with these old diving helmets and the tube going to the surface. Well, these guys are going very deep, among other reasons, because that's where they can find the sponges. And why you don't find the sponges in shallower waters? Well, basically because you have taken all of them. Even in ancient times, we can see that. There is a reference to, we know that they were using red coral, which was very common in the Mediterranean, for jewelry and things like that. In Bronze Age, in Minoan times, for example, we know they were using sponges in the Palace of Knossos, very, you know, very famous palace in the island of Crete, because the painting technique for the fresco, think about it, I think it's fascinating. The painting technique for the fresco, they apply the color with a sponge. So we have the markers of the sponge being used for creating these artistic representations. In Roman times, they had to invent some kind of metal rack boxes kind of thing to pick up coral because they couldn't find the coral in shallower waters. Because the one they could pick up just by free diving to these depths we were mentioning, it was gone. So they had to create these tools to basically go deeper. They depleted the red coral by, I don't know, 500, 300 BCE, for example. So is that true? Is that not true? I think that for the 19th century, it could be true, and I would like to learn more and do more research about that. I still find the reference to Aristotle confusing. I just need more research because many traditional cultures that practice freediving, we were mentioning the Bajau, the Ama, I have no reference, at least I didn't find it, on the Ama doing the same, you know? And I think the way the Ama dive is closer to these divers in Greece, I don't know, 3,000 years ago, 2,500 years ago, than the Greeks themselves 150, 200 years ago. Because the activity is the same and the environment is kind of the same in the sense that you didn't deplete the shallower waters.
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely, I've had a student, a Japanese student of mine, Seiji. Hey, Seiji, if you're listening, Seiji was an amazing student. And he had a hole in his ear, you know, so like he could easily blow air out of his ear. So it was significant enough that, you know, you could see that. But also he was still able to equalize, which is, you know, equally fascinating how he was doing that. So yeah, I mean, there's a possibility, but that's good. I'm going to come back to the ear thing in a little bit with I'm going to ask you about a very famous story in free diving. You might, you know, anticipate what's coming, but before we get to that, another thing that, because you mentioned nose clips, and we're talking about divers diving thousands of years ago. Do you know much about the Moken and their eyes, and what do you think the solutions for masks were in the ancient past?
Yeah, that was, I honestly think that we have no masks in the past as far as I was able to find on my research. We have reference for other things. Again, our friend Aristotle mentions a snorkel, which I find fascinating, and I hope that in the future I can do some experiments on that. And actually, it's pretty descriptive. Do you know these snorkels that swimmers use on the swimming pool for training?
Yeah, the ones that come on the front of the head?
Absolutely, those ones, okay? So if everybody can keep that image, you know, in their minds, what he's describing is a tube made out of reeds that divers use while on the surface. I mean, that is obviously the description of a snorkel, yeah? And that tube made them look like elephants.
Right.
So if you have that image of the swimmer with a tube just in front of his head, and now you think about an elephant, you know, rising the trunk, that's basically what you have. You know, a tube that goes in front of your face. We couldn't find any. One thing I love about my work is what we call experimental archaeology, is that gather all the evidence about ancient technology and then try to make it happen. I think it can work because we also have straps, not for the snorkel. Again, it's an isolated reference, but they used to play a flute called the diaulos. It was like a double flute. You need to imagine the piper with two tubes out of his mouth or her mouth, made with the same reeds as these snorkels. And because it was so complicated to put both flutes on the mouth at the same time, they developed some leather straps that went to the back of the head, two straps. They meet in a mouthpiece in front of the mouth to isolate the air, so you could only blow these musical instruments, you know, these pipes, through a little opening in your mouth. Again, I'm sure you can all be imagining now these straps, you know, like silicone or whatever modern straps, and then the mouthpiece of the snorkel. So if instead of putting these two pipes, you put a snorkel going up, here you have your Aristotle snorkel. Masks, again, no reference. I know the Moken ones. I know that in the Persian Gulf, as I said, they use both nose clips and some kind of swimming paddies, not for their feet, not fins as we understand them, but some kind of flat pieces, again, made of probably of turtle shell, that they used to have like an extra grip while moving their hands.
Mm.
In terms of diving and diving technology, that's what we know. In terms of tools for picking up stuff, we have more information, a more descriptive, but also more material culture about the tools they use, for example, for going for sponges or other things.
Yeah, it's totally fascinating to think that, you know, so much of... you know, there could have been some kind of a mast, there could have been some kind of a snorkel, there could have been some kind of fins, but, you know, the chances of you stumbling upon one now at this point are, it's like finding a, you know, a needle, a very small needle in a very, very big haystack. So it's very tantalizing, but obviously...
It's even worse. It's looking for that needle, not knowing if the needle is there.
Right, okay.
Yeah. One of the main problems I had was the... misidentification of the material record, and again, I mean, everybody's more than happy to pick up my papers on my online accounts, or I can give them to you. Please read them, enjoy them, have fun with them. And I mentioned a specific pot, a hydria, for you know, for water, which has a depiction of a sea creature and a male figure, you know, and. That's the point. We know from our friend Opian that they were diving with long ropes tied to their waist, lead weights, a sharp, he calls like a bill, is like a curved knife, you know, like a small hand sickle, if you want to put it that way, which makes sense. When you're diving and you want to pick up a sponge, it's better to have something like a small sickle, because in one movement, you just can take the sponge out. You don't need to move your straight knife as a saw. It's about burning oxygen underwater, basically. We have that description, and then we have this pot specifically. And when I found this Greek pot, no author describing it was able to see a freediver. So if you go for keywords, you know, or you go for references, like ancient Greece freediver or something like that, you are not going to find this spot, because people reading them, they are not familiar with freediving. They don't have to, obviously. We cannot know everything about everything, but they were projecting what they thought they were seeing. So this curved knife was considered a fish hook, Now, if you see this picture, it's come on, it has a handle.
Right.
You know, it's not a fish hook, but big marine creature, curvy thing, is a fish hook. Well, no, it's not. And then we have this saying curved knives in the archaeological record. We can, I have handled them. And they are made of bronze. And that one of the things I mentioned on my research is that why are you making, for example, in 6th century BCE, bronze knives? I mean, people may think, well, Emilio, what was the problem? Well, the problem is money. Bronze is much more expensive than iron. And especially because you need tin, you know, it's copper and tin, and that tin is coming to Greece from far, 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 far away. It's coming from Spain, northern Spain, like Galicia, my homeland, even the British Isles.
Mm, yeah.
So it's very expensive commodity. Why are you putting your money in a bronze knife that is gonna lose the edge faster than an iron knife when iron is actually cheaper? Well, perhaps if you're a diver and you're going to spend a lot of time underwater picking up sponges, it's actually cheaper that you get a bronze knife, because iron, especially iron at that time, we are not talking about, you know, the steel we have nowadays, rusts very, very, very quickly, very quickly. So if I get a bronze knife, it's enough edge to pick up my sponges or other things, to harvest my coral. And I'm not going to be basically spending money on iron knives all the time. So nowadays, if I encounter a bronze sickle-shaped knife, like the ones I've got some pictures here from a museum in Eritrea, in the island of Euboea, well, I get suspicious. You know, it's like, this could be something divers or fishermen working at the sea would be happy to you.
Yeah, and I've seen those pictures, and I'll make sure to put those in the show notes along with the interview. Right, and then like coming on to Greece in particular,
sure.
A place that's very kind of like fond in my heart. You know, you have done, obviously this is the kind of like the core of your knowledge here is sponge fishermen in ancient Greece. But not, I mean, I guess not just ancient Greece, but even into modern times as well. Tell us a little bit about how that worked, like in terms of what do you know about the practical aspects of free diving for sponges? And can we still find people in Greece today who are diving this way?
And in other places of the Mediterranean, like Sardinia, for example. Sure. Basically, I'm sure that people who like to watch Scandalopetra competition videos are gonna realize that I'm basically describing them. The practice of free diving in ancient Greece consisted of a diver with this curved sickle-shaped knife, a long rope tied to his or her waist. This gender thing is super important. It's one of my happiest discoveries on this research. I'm sure we can chat a little bit about that later. And a heavy lead weight. They didn't use, we are perhaps more used to the marble weight we can see in Scandalopetra nowadays. Ancient authors mentioned lead, which was a very common commodity there. And it's about volume, you know, you can get the same, I mean, we have lead weights in diving today. Nothing to explain about that. And a mouthful of olive oil. They used to get olive oil on their mouths before the diving. I'll explain why in a second. For everybody out there, fan of yoga and free diving, and I know you are for sure one of them, ancient authors mentioned that sponge divers used to prepare their voice as the singers or the actors, you know, that they were going to perform to warm up their voices. Obviously, what they were doing was increasing their lung capacity. You have to realize that when you were an actor performing in the theater of Dionysus in Athens, you just have your voice and a mask in front of you to an audience of 17,000 people, I think is the capacity we consider those theaters have. So you really need to project your voice.
Right.
You know, you really need like a good strong voice. I got a friend who from a fellowship program I was involved some years ago that is an opera singer. I'm super curious about having the time to ask her how she prepares her voice, you know, for opera singing. I think it would be fascinating to make the comparison. But obviously what they are doing is increasing their lung capacity. And the idea is actually very simple. They jump out of the boat. We have even some ceramics showing that. They go down, they pick up whatever they are gathering, coral, mollusks, sponges, whatever. And when they are ready to come back, they pull up the rope, and somebody is on the boat, is just, you know, pulling the rope to take them quickly to the surface. Basically, the Escandalopetra that now, I think it's CIMAS, who has actually like an official competition in Escandalopetra. That's what we can see. Regarding the mouthful of olive oil, it's another fascinating example of people just getting the craziest ideas about that. Some say that it was for kind of protecting the Stockian tubes, that they were moving the olive oil from their mouth to their Stockian tubes to protect them from the water. I kind of don't get that very well. I'm not saying it's not possible. I just don't see the process. And I've got a easier explanation because I've got many references about this. The olive oil has refractory properties. So what I consider as the most plausible explanation, at least up to the point I'm able to do an experiment, is that they were spitting. They were actually spitting the olive oil when they were reaching the depth they were aiming at, to kind of like a flashlight. I know it sounds crazy, but paradoxically, we've got examples of divers, pearl divers in the northern shores of Venezuela during the Spanish domination there, and a British captain, Navy captain, is describing how these divers are diving. And he mentions the exact same technique, that they put this olive oil in their mouths and they went to the bottom, they spit out the olive oil in order to see better, you know, and pick up more easily these, the shells that were, the oysters that were collecting for the pearls. And actually, I got another reference from the 20th century that in the Balearic Islands in Mallorca, traditional fishers were pouring from the boat olive oil close to the areas they thought they could find octopi in order basically to see better, to increase the luminosity of that part of the sea and being able to see better the octopi. Obviously, olive oil is a Mediterranean thing, so although we have frescoes showing pearl divers in Central America before the arrival of the Spaniards, it is impossible that this olive oil technique, it's a Maya thing, you know, or it's a Mesoamerica thing, because they didn't have olive oil. This is something the Spanish conquistadors, the Spanish rulers, are taking from the Mediterranean to the New World, which means that from the time Oppians, for example, is mentioning that in 2nd century CE, Common Era, that technique needs to be constantly used, at least in the Mediterranean, until the 15th, 16th century, because Spanish need to know that to take it there. And I think that is just honestly fascinating. I'm sure that I'm repeating fascinating a lot, sorry to everybody listening to me, but I'm just super excited about this topic, and I love these little stories and little connections.
Yeah, I'm absolutely fascinated by it as well. And but one of the things I'm not quite certain about there is, what do you mean about what the olive oil does? Can you explain a little bit again how it helps you see better, or how it might help you see better in that situation?
Sure. Sorry. Basically, what these people are saying, and again, I would love to test this in a kind of scientific experiment, is that it reflects the sun rays in such a way that at least for these depths, I mean, again, we are talking about 15 meters, 20 meters, 8 meters, okay? it's kind of bouncing the sun rays inside the little drops of olive oil, so they will start to kind of glow as an underwater light. Make sense?
It makes sense, but I'm still okay. Right, the first thing I'm going to do when I get back to my little island is crack open the olive oil, and so that's going to be
Please let me know. Please let me know. It would
5th
be
of
super
March, Emilio. Yes,
fascinating.
5th of March, Emilio. I'm doing a course. The first thing we're going to do is go and spit some olive oil into the water.
Yeah, I'm sure that this is not happening, obviously, at 35, 40 meters. All the references I have found are these lower depths, obviously. And again, it's something that I've not been able to test. And that's the beauty of this research, you know, that the possibility of doing these experiments to see if these references make sense or not.
Okay, well, I'm happy to help you do some research there. I
Fantastic.
have
That would
some good.
it would be an excellent paper, to be
Yeah.
honest. It would be an excellent paper.
I have some good Cretan olive oil back at the shop. I'm looking forward to, actually tastes good. All right, so and then to sort of like wrap things up here a little bit, I want to come to the story of and I'm not 100% sure how to pronounce this, but Haggis Statsis, which I'm sure you've heard all about. Yeah, maybe for are you very familiar with the story?
Quite, I think.
Okay.
It's basically one of the most common examples of these early days of free diving when when everybody thought we were going to die at 15 or 20 meters.
Yeah, maybe you could for the sake of the listeners who haven't heard this story yet, maybe you could give us a sort of brief rundown of what the story is, and then your thoughts on the legitimacy of the claims made about Hagis
Well, if I am remembering the story correctly and with all the details, we are talking about a free diver, yeah, a sponge diver, I think, if I am not wrong. He work on a sponge free diver. We were mentioning this 20, early 20 century Greek divers going for sponges on a kind of depleted sea. So it was the Italian Navy. Am I wrong?
Yeah, I think it was the Italian Navy. Yeah,
I'm pretty sure
they
it was
lost an anchor.
it was the Italian Navy. So well, you have this free diver Yorgos Hagi Stati, a Greek diver. We need to remember that this is 1911, so it's dangerous because we want to believe that, yeah, we have a lot of information about this. We have, but we don't. It's complex. The ship was the Regina Margherita. It was the Regina Margherita. So we are in 1911, and they basically are in the Aegean, and they get their anchor stuck on the bottom of the sea. They couldn't move the ship, but they couldn't recover the anchor. And basically, what happens is that it was like over 60 meters deep, which crazy depth, of course. And he basically went to the Italian Navy and said, "Okay, if you pay me some money and you allow me to use dynamite for fishing," which is now we say this and it's like, oh my God, this is crazy. But I was working at Corinth for my dissertation in the Corinthian Gulf. This was like 2014, 15, and using explosives and fishing. Let's say that you could hear from time to time some explosions on the Gulf. I cannot believe this is still happening, but sorry, I'm losing my point here.
Yeah,
Anyway.
I also heard it in Indonesia as well. I'm pretty certain that's what was happening.
Yeah, I mean it's good. Anyway, he asked for money and this permission to do this, you know? And I can do it, I can do it. I just can, you know, retrieve the anchor so you don't need to put the money on this. And he did. The whole point of this story is that he just free diving, he went over 60 meters, and he recovered the anchor, and and so they didn't have to find a new one, and so on. What happened is that, well, as any military ship, there was a doctor on board, and he was fascinating about the performance of this Greek diver. So he recorded everything and he published everything. And for a long time, it was diminished as something crazy. Basically, people thought, no, this is a lie. It couldn't be real. Over 7 minutes underwater, you know, like, and 60 meters, this has to be a lie. The timing you were mentioning, you know, that when you are on top of the, when you're on the shore, perhaps time goes at a different speed. I presume that the doctor recording this had some kind of chronometer or something. It was, I mean, it was a, they, he recovered the anchor. That is a fact. The anchor came back to the ship. Now, was it 7 minutes? Was it over 60 meters? We only have the data from the doctor. I have no reason to not believe in the record of this Italian doctor, to be honest. I mean, I cannot imagine what kind of benefit this doctor may have by lying about this. So I honestly find no reason. I presume that as an scholar, what I say is, which is what I always say on any research, is like, okay, this is an interesting evidence, but I need more, you know? And we have no more evidence about this story. What it is a fact is that this happened before the development of what we can say modern day free diving, you know? Because this is 1911. So there was this story, you know, out there saying that we humans could go below 30 meters, 50 meters, 60 meters, and nobody believed that. And then we just started to as a species, you know, to break those records and understand our physiology much better. What I find unfair about this kind of disbelief is not only about Stati, it's about all these traditional free divers we were mentioning before, you know, that were out there in the world doing these dives, perhaps not up to 60 meters for the anchor, but up to 25, 30 meters, you know, that anybody could have a look and record and make experiments and so on. And nobody was believing these depths either, you know, from all these communities. So the evidence was there. You need to be a little bit more open-minded. You don't trust this single record? Perfect. I understand. It's only one record. As a researcher, I can totally get your point. Go there. Do your research. You have people diving below 10 meters in 1911. For sure. I mean, for sure. So that's kind of the, he's considered Stati the father of free diving. Perhaps because of the role this story played on the origins of the discipline, but without taking any merit away from him, you have all these cultures doing awesome feats on free diving, you know, before we Westerners put the certification seal on this story, you know, this seal, now I believe it, you know, people were doing these things. I mean, we need to be more open-minded and more, to have more empathy, if you allow me the expression, you know. It's like, you don't need to believe everything you hear. Actually, I suggest you the completely opposite, you know. You need to have a critical thinking. It's an essential skill, but okay. Test it. Do experiments. That's the basis of the scientific method, isn't it?
Yeah, well, I mean, whatever the case, you know, whatever the truth is, I mean, you hear, 60 meters, you hear 80 meters, you hear a lot of different things about this story. I think one of the nice things about it, one of the funny things about it as well, is that, you know, the doctor who examined him, you know, said that he, you know, generally looked like he was in pretty poor health, and he was smoking cigarettes, and one of his eardrums was you know, had a hole in it, and the other one was completely gone or something like this. So it just paints this quite interesting picture of this fella, Yorgos, who probably would have been quite an interesting person to have a drink with, no doubt, back on the shore.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
In Greece, you even have dances, like traditional dances, that the movements try to mimic the seizures of sponge divers who had issues, we know, with the nitrogen coming back and so on. We all know how that works, that they basically couldn't dive anymore, and they have all these health problems and this kind of they had these shaky movements forever. There are even dancers depicting trying to mimic these movements, and at the end of the dance, of this traditional dance, they kind of recover suddenly, and I always thought, it's such a sad reminder. I mean, the dance is beautiful, don't get me wrong, I love them, but if you think about it, it's basically this person who has destroyed his, her, or her health. In this case, it's only his health, male divers in the 19th, 20th century, destroyed his health, performing these super risky tasks. At the end of the dance, they come back to normal, which is something you know it won't happen on real life, you know? So it's kind of expressing a wish of recovery that is never going to happen. I always found it so, so moving, to be honest, so, so moving. The beautiful, beautiful dances. If I just have 3 seconds, if you allow me, sorry, because one of the things I really would like to point out, I'm happiest about my research, is that I was able to discover that in ancient Greece, at least, free diving was not only practiced by men, but also by women, at least unmarried women. They are there, they are out, they are free diving, they are collecting sponges. And in fact, even one of the military actions I was telling at the beginning of the interview, it was a father with her daughter, not son, his daughter, sorry, that they were able to sink or help sinking, thanks to a storm, a Persian fleet when the Persians were invading Greece in 480. And we are very sure about that because they put a statue of her in the at Delphi, the famous Oracle of Delphi, and so on. And several authors, Pausanias, for example, records that this statue is there. I saw it. And for this male-dominated society that was ancient Greece to put a statue of this woman in a sanctuary, like a public display, saying this person with Hypne was the name, with her father Aeschylus, did this this commando attack, is very strong evidence, to be honest, that she was diving. And we all know, I mean, I suppose everybody listening to the podcast will agree with me, you cannot learn freediving by chance. If you are doing this kind of commando attack, getting undetected in the water, diving down to cut the ropes with our friend, the sickle-shaped knife of the anchor, so the Persian ships are drifted by the storm, you need to be a diver. You just cannot do that, you know, by chance. Like, oh, I want to sink some Persian ships. I'm just going to go underwater and cut the ropes without being detected by the sentinels on the ship. It cannot happen. So this woman had to be a diver.
Yeah, I mean, I wish I had a time machine so that I could go back and visit all these times and places that we've been talking about today, Emilio, and find out for myself what it looked like, you know, to see an ancient breath-hold diver in action. It's been absolutely fascinating listening to you discuss these things with me. It raises, you know, again, with this kind of topic, it raises so many more questions for me than it answers. But it's been really good to get a nice kind of overview here of this ancient freediving history and up to modern times. Okay, let's fire into these desert island questions, Emilio, because it's always a lot of fun and it's a nice way to wind down the interview. We're going to start with, what is your perfect morning routine? What would it be if you could do it anyway? This section of the show is recorded especially for the tender ears of Freedive Cafe Patreon supporters, and you can get access to that at patreon.com/freedivecafe. Very nice words, Emilio. Perfect. Emilio, if people want to find out, now I'm going to put as much of this stuff into the show notes as possible, but if people want to find out more about you or get in touch with you, what's the best way for them to do that?
Sure. In my email, all lowercase, emilio.rodriguez.alvarez@gmail.com. throw me an email, more than happy. If people are interested in my research, I always put all my papers and publications on my account on ResearchGate or academia.edu. I'm more than happy to share the links with you, Donnie, and they can just click and see everything I publish or I will publish, I hope, in the future. In fact, for everybody out there, one of the version of these notes is a poster I presented at a conference that they are more than happy to download if they want to print it, like A0 printing, and put them on their shops, on their training centers, or whatever, or to use them for teaching a little bit of this topic on freediving. Anything everybody want for non-commercial purposes, more than happy to download and share and print and do everything they want.
Perfect. I'm gonna get one of those posters for my own place.
Please, please, please do so.
But this is actually, you know, really nice for me, because this is more the kind of topics and subjects that I want to do this year, is like diversify mm-hmm. a little bit and get down into some really interesting topics, you know, outside yeah. of purely training. Yeah, Emilio, it's been such a pleasure having you here. Like, it's, for me, ancient history is one of the most fascinating topics that I can imagine, and I could just get lost for hours and hours going down into, you know, ancient Greece and Rome and, you know, even further back. And to combine a little bit of that with, you know, our mutual passion for freediving has been super interesting. So thank you so much for coming on the show.
No, thank you. Thank you very much for having me. I'm a great fan of the show. And in fact, as I think I told you in an email, that was the show I was listening to on my podcast when I every morning go into the swimming pool to do some swimming and, you know, diving, little diving. Before work when I was doing my PhD. So it's not a pleasure, it's an honor to have been invited, and I only hope that people have found this research interesting on free diving and to, you know, to learn that what we do it actually has a very, very, very long and I hope interesting story as well, and
yeah.
history.
And this podcast is now part of that story, so that's a nice way to contribute.
Thank you very much.
Nice. Okay, take it easy. Enjoy the rest of your day there in Spain, Emilio, and I'll be in touch with you soon. Take care and dive safe.
You as well. Dive safe.
Okay, bye-bye. That was Emilio with a fascinating and wide-ranging conversation about freediving in antiquity. It puts lots of wild, fun thoughts in my head, which I love. Thanks, Emilio. We can't wait to read your book on freediving one day. Don't forget your 10% discount on To Be Free equipment using the discount code FREEDIVECAFE at tobefreeequipment.com. Don't forget to check out the new podcast of mine, The Thrivers Podcast. Here it's up to number 26 in Portugal now. Whatever that means, on any good podcast player app, Thrivers Podcast. And until next time, when we'll have Mr. Dan Verhoeven back on the show, man, getting sick of that guy, for a deep dive into the technicals of freediving photography. Until then, dive safe.